From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
For the past couple of years, there's been a push to privatize the nation's highways that's being pushed by investment banks and by the Bush administration.
In the wake of the fatal bridge collapse in Minnesota, we'll look at the nation's crumbling infrastructure and why private investment firms like Goldman Sachs and Carlyle Group are pushing for the privatization of highways. Then a shocking new report in Mother Jones magazine on the Oklahoma City bombing. We'll speak with investigative reporter Jim Ridgway.
The government has methodically covered up facts involving the Oklahoma City bombing case. Facts that suggest there was a much greater conspiracy.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Up to 30 people are missing following Wednesday's collapse of Minnesota's busiest bridge. Rescue workers have recovered four bodies, but more are feared trapped inside cars that sunk into the Mississippi River. 79 people are injured. This is Minnesota Fire Chief Jim Clack.
We're concerned about the structural stability of the bridge still, the pieces that remain off the ground. And so we're going to be very careful to use the experts to make sure our rescue workers are safe. This is not a rescue operation any longer. It's a recovery operation, which means we move slower and more deliberately.
The developments come as U.S. officials admitted alarm bells were first raised about the bridge 17 years ago. The Department of Transportation rated the bridge as structurally deficient and began yearly repairs. 2 years ago, inspectors gave the same rating and said the bridge would possibly need replacement. More than 70,000 bridges across the country have also been rated structurally deficient. There are new developments in the debate over the Bush administration's warrantless spying program. The Washington Post is reporting a federal intelligence court judge ruled earlier this year that a key part of the wiretap effort is illegal. The judge ruled the administration had violated its authority in trying to monitor overseas communications routed through the United States. The Bush administration has argued that all parts of the program are legal. The Washington Post reports the ruling has provided an undeclared motivation for this week's congressional push to expand President Bush's spying powers. Lawmakers are considering a Democratic proposal that would expand the wiretapping for another 6 months, but keep them under jurisdiction of a secret intelligence court. Democratic leaders say they want to pass a bill before the August recess. Democratic Senator Russ Feingold of Wisconsin is leading calls to stall a vote until privacy concerns can be addressed. The Senate has passed a bipartisan bill that would expand health insurance to millions of low-income American children. The 68-31 vote follows House approval a day earlier. The margin would be enough to override a threatened presidential veto from the White House. President Bush says he's against the bill because it would increase the government role in health care. The Senate version would boost spending on the state children's health insurance program, known as SCHIP, by $35 billion over 5 years. The cigarette tax would be raised to $1 a pack. The Senate funding falls short of the $50 billion approved by the House. Senators rejected an amendment that would match the House increase by raising taxes on Americans making more than $1 million a year. In other news from Washington, D.C., the Senate has approved a new ethics bill that would ban lobbyist-paid gifts, meals, and travel, and impose rules on how lawmakers capitalize on political connections once leaving office. Lobbyists and lawmakers would be forced to disclose large contributions over short time periods. But some critics say the new restrictions are too lax. Lawmakers would be allowed to waive a requirement that says they must announce earmarks at least 48 hours before a vote. In Oakland, a veteran journalist and editor has been killed in what police say was a targeted shooting. 58-year-old Chauncey Bailey had recently been promoted editor of the Oakland Post. He was shot multiple times in downtown Oakland on Thursday morning. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice has wrapped up her visit to Israel and the occupied territories. On Thursday, Rice met with Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas in Ramallah to show support for the Fatah leader in his power struggle with Hamas. The two signed a deal to release the first $10 million of $80 million in frozen U.S. aid. The agreement came days after the U.S. announced a 25% increase in military aid to Israel to $3 billion. Rice said the Bush administration supports democracy in the Middle East, but defended its decision to boycott Palestinians for electing Hamas. Rice said, quote, "We believe strongly in the right of people to express themselves and their desires in elections," but added, "You have the obligation to govern responsibly." Hamas leader Mahmoud Azahar dismissed Rice's visit as a PR stunt.
"This visit comes as a public relations stunt to help the suffering credibility of Mahmoud Abbas and also the credibility of weak Israeli government. This is an attempt to give the impression that something might happen for the Palestinian people from these visits. The money that is allocated using these methods has all been against the Palestinian well-being and has harmed whoever took it. We say that the Palestinian people have waited for a long time from this leadership and in return did not even get the minimum."
Jury deliberations begin today in the military trial of a U.S. soldier accused in the rape and murder of the 14-year-old Iraqi teenager Abir Qasim Hamza and the killing of her parents and her 5-year-old sister in the town of Mahmoudiya last year. The soldier, Private First Class Jesse Spielman, is accused of conspiracy to commit rape and murder. 3 service members have already been convicted in the case. The alleged ringleader, former soldier Stephen Green, awaits trial in a civilian court. Support is growing in the U.S. for Iraqi oil workers striking against the U.S.-backed oil law under debate in Iraq. The main union representing American oil workers is calling on Congress to stop pressuring Iraq to pass the law and to shift support to the Iraqi oil workers' demands. In a letter to House and Senate leaders, United Steelworkers President Leo Gerard says, quote, "The oil privatization law now under consideration by Iraq's government is designed to benefit the multinational oil companies, not the Iraqi people." In Britain, an independent police oversight board has ruled Britain's top counterterrorism officer misled the public about the deadly shooting of Jean-Charles de Meneses. De Meneses is the innocent Brazilian man who was shot dead after British police mistook him for a suicide bomber. The counterterrorism officer, Assistant Commissioner Andy Heyman, did not report that de Meneses was unarmed. That led London Police Chief Ian Blair to falsely announce de Meneses had refused to obey police instructions. On Thursday, Blair apologized to the victim's family.
"I want to say again that I am very sorry that some information released to the public was wrong and increased the grief of the de Meneses family. I hope, however, that the shortcomings which occurred will be seen in the light both of the extraordinary challenge we faced and the significant steps we have since taken to improve."
Okay. Prosecutors say they won't charge any of the officers involved in the shooting. Speaking in London, de Meneses' cousin, Patricia Armani da Silva, said their family has been denied justice.
"Ninguém foi responsabilizado por nada.
No one has been held responsible for anything.
Ninguém vai ser processado.
No one is going to be prosecuted.
E eles estão permitindo que a polícia se livre de crime de assassinato."
"And the police have been allowed to get away with murder."
In Chile, police have captured a fugitive general who escaped just before he was set to begin a jail term for crimes committed under the dictator Augusto Pinochet. Retired General Raul Iturriaga had been on the run since June. This is Chilean government spokesperson Lagos Weber.
"I can guarantee the criminal Iturriaga has been arrested, that he will have to carry out the sentence handed down by the Chilean courts."
In Colombia, the father of a hostage held by the rebel group FARC has met with Colombian President Alvaro Uribe after walking more than 500 miles on a protest march. Gustavo Moncayo is calling on Uribe to reach an accord with the rebels. Uribe says he will agree to establish a special zone to hold talks, but is refusing FARC demands it be demilitarized. After the meeting, Moncayo criticized Uribe's stance.
"The president comes out here in public and says that we are going to be finished with these bandits and we will eliminate these delinquents. It's like stabbing us in the heart. the heart of the family members. It's like dying to us. I decided to take the initiative and come here to protest with my chains. These chains are for the president, because he is not the owner of life, to say go and rescue them. The president is not the god of life, and it hurts me. It hurts me.
The fruit giant Chiquita International is claiming it failed to stop illegally paying right-wing Colombia militias because the Bush administration never responded to the company's admission that it was making the payments. Earlier this year, Chiquita agreed to pay a $25 million fine for making $1.7 million in payments to the United Self-Defense Forces of Colombia, considered a terrorist organization by the U.S. government. But Chiquita now says those payments may have had at least the tacit approval of the Bush administration. The Washington Post reports a Chiquita board member met with Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff in April 2003 while Chertoff was at the Justice Department. The board member, Roderick Hills, reportedly told Chertoff that Chiquita knew the payments were illegal but would have to end operations in Colombia if it stopped making them. Several sources say Chertoff agreed the payments were illegal but agreed the situation was, quote, complicated. Chertoff advised Hills to wait for more feedback before taking action. Chiquita says the feedback never came and that it left the meeting with the message the Bush administration did not object to the payments. Chiquita kept making payments for nearly another year. And the District of Columbia has agreed to pay $1 million to more than 100 demonstrators rounded up and detained during an anti-war protest in September of 2002. The settlement is Washington's largest to date for the police crackdown on the protest. D.C. previously agreed to pay more than $640,000 to 14 other demonstrators. A larger class action suit covering more than 400 people awaits trial. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In the wake of Wednesday's fatal bridge collapse over the Mississippi River in Minneapolis, the condition of the nation's highway system is coming under increased scrutiny. In 1990, the U.S. government rated the Minneapolis Bridge as structurally deficient and possibly in need of replacement. That rating was contained in the Department of Transportation's National Bridge Inventory Database. More than 70,000 bridges across the country have also been rated structurally deficient. The American Society of Civil Engineers estimates it would take nearly $190 billion to fix these bridges over the next two decades. In Minnesota, many residents have begun questioning the spending priorities of the state and the nation. Nick Coleman of the Star Tribune wrote a column yesterday entitled, "Public Anger Will Follow Our Sorrow." He points out the motto of Governor Tim Pawlenty has been, "No New Taxes." Last spring, Pawlenty vetoed a 5-cent gas tax increase, the first in 20 years, that would have produced millions of dollars in revenue to help fix roads. Nick Coleman wrote, quote, "At the federal level, the parsimony is worse, and so is the negligence. A trillion spent in Iraq while schools crumble. There aren't enough cops on the street, and bridges decay while our leaders cross their fingers and ignore the rising chances of disaster." On the national level, the Highway Trust Fund is about to go broke. When President Bush took office, the fund had a $23 billion surplus, but it's expected to be running a deficit by next year, in part because Bush killed an increase in gas taxes 2 years ago. The columnist Jim Hightower recently accused the government of deliberately defunding these vital infrastructure projects in an effort to open the door to privatization. Investment firms including Goldman Sachs, the Carlyle Group, Merrill Lynch, and Morgan Stanley are forming large funds to purchase publicly owned infrastructure projects. And the privatization of the nation's roads has already begun. In Indiana, Governor Mitch Daniels has leased the 157-mile Indiana toll road to a foreign consortium from Spain and Australia for $3.85 billion over the next 75 years. But one calculation the toll road will generate, $11 billion over the life of the lease. Indiana's Governor Mitch Daniels has been nicknamed Mr. Privatized by some for his willingness to sell off public assets. Before coming to Indiana, Daniels served as the president's White House budget director. And Indiana's not alone. An Illinois official signed a 99-year, $1.8 billion lease to hand over the Chicago Skyway. To talk more about the privatization of the nation's highways, we're joined by two reporters from Mother Jones Magazine. James Ridgway and Daniel Shulman. Earlier this year, they co-wrote an article entitled The Highwaymen, Why You Could Soon Be Paying Wall Street Investors, Australian Bankers, and Spanish Builders for the Privilege of Driving on American Roads. We welcome you both to Democracy Now!, and I want to begin with Daniel Shulman. Why don't you start off by giving us the background on the privatization or the building of U.S. highways? You talk about President Eisenhower.
Right. Well, he signed into law the Federal Aid Highway Act in 1956, which really brought the federal interstate highway system that we know now, and it was supposed to be free, and it was supposed to be accessible to everyone, and it was supposed to interconnect the communities in this country. It was really one of the major initiatives of his administration.
And so what happened from there?
Well, over time, there hasn't been very much commitment at the federal or state level to funding infrastructure projects. As you see in Minnesota, people are very afraid to raise the gas tax. They're afraid that this is going to impact, I'm talking about elected officials, this is going to impact their reelection chances. So over time, it's just become a lot easier for them to look to get a big upfront payment. They can use that in the interim to pay down debt, or in the case of Indiana, to put towards other infrastructure projects. And down the road, you know, people are going to have to bear the cost of that, because this asset is not going to be under their control anymore.
Jim Ridgway, the piece is called The Highwaymen, Why You Soon Will Be Paying Wall Street Investors, Australian Bankers, and Spanish Builders for the Privilege of Driving on American Roads. Explain who the players are right now. Who's taking over U.S. highways?
Well, it's, you know, it's all in process. I mean, the thing is that the major Wall Street investment companies are trying to link up with various international partners in Australia and Spain and elsewhere to essentially buy this sort of decaying or infrastructure that is in need of repair. And this is, it's appealing, as Dan, I think, mentioned, it's appealing to the local politicians because it looks like they're getting some cash from these guys in Wall Street, and they're not going to have to raise taxes to fix the roads. And there's the illusion that sooner or later these roads will get fixed. Now, you know, whether that happens or not is like anybody's guess. Because when this actually takes place, when the actual improvement of the roads is done, is going to be when all these politicians are dead and gone. Hmm.
Daniel Shulman, in the piece, you write, 50 years to the day after Ike put his pen to the Highway Act, another Republican signed off on another historic highway project. On June 29, 2006, Mitch Daniels, former Bush administration official turned governor of Indiana, was greeted with a round of applause as he stepped into a conference room packed with reporters and state lawmakers. The last of eight wire transfers had landed in the state's count, making it official. Indiana had received $3.8 billion from a foreign consortium made up of a Spanish construction firm, Cintra, the Macquarie Infrastructure Group of Australia. In exchange, the state would hand over the operation of the 157-mile Indiana Toll Road for the next 75 years. And it goes on from there. Talk about the political climate. How did people in Indiana, how did Hoosiers feel about this?
People were absolutely, I went to Indiana shortly after that, and people were absolutely outraged. If you travel that toll road, even now, I think, and talk to people, they still don't understand why this road that really is part of their, you know, cultural, it's just like the rest of the roads in this country, we really feel a deep affinity for them, why this is in the hands of a foreign consortium. And some of it is xenophobia, some of it they don't want foreigners running their roads, but some of it is also they've got, you know, they've asked really hard questions about this. Are we getting a good deal? And, you know, frankly, a lot of people are saying no. You cited the figure before that some say that Indiana, over the life of this contract, the road could have generated $11 billion. So that's a $7 billion net loss for the taxpayers of Indiana. No, people in Indiana are outraged, and elsewhere, too. You've seen in New Jersey recently, there was a backlash against the potential plan to privatize the New Jersey Turnpike, which some said could bring in as much as $20 billion. I was driving that road recently, and there was a big sign, a big billboard, you know, against this privatization plan, and the plan has been pulled at this point.
You're right. In fact, Daniels argued in a paper he wrote for the Reason Foundation last spring, any business person will recognize our decision here as the freeing of trapped value from an underperforming asset to be redeployed into a better use with higher returns, Daniel.
Yeah, well, that's kind of the euphemisms that they're using right now. But there are other ways to do this. If a state wanted to, if the state needed to generate more money, they could try to refinance the road, and they could get their $3.8 billion, put it into infrastructure, and still keep control of the road. So yes, you'll hear Daniels and you'll hear the investment bankers say it. I just don't know if it's completely true.
We're going to continue our discussion and talk about what Minneapolis has to do with this with Jim Ridgway, Washington bureau chief for the Mother Jones, and Daniel Shulman, associate editor of Mother Jones. And then we're going to go on to talk about Oklahoma City with Jim Ridgway and why talk about that more than a decade later. Stay with us.
Well, that's 61 Highway. You know that 61 highway, they belong in road, I know. She run from New York City, down the Gulf of Mexico. You know some folks say, some Greyhound buses don't run. You know it's some folks say, some Greyhound buses don't run.
Highway 61, Fred McDowell here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're talking to Jim Ridgway and Daniel Shulman. They have written the piece for Mother Jones magazine called The Highwaymen, Why You Could Soon Be Paying Wall Street Investors, Australian Bankers, and Spanish Builders for the Privilege of Driving on American Roads. I want to take this back to Minneapolis and the horror that they've experienced now after the Interstate 35W bridge collapsed on Wednesday evening. Nick Coleman, in this very moving piece, Public Anger Will Follow Our Sorrow, says Minneapolis suffered a perfect storm of nightmares Wednesday evening, as anyone who couldn't sleep will tell you, including the parents who clench their jaws and tighten their hands on the wheel every time they drive a carload of strapped-in kids across a steep chasm or a rushing river. Don't panic, you tell yourself. The people in charge of this know what they're doing. They make sure the bridges stay standing. And if there were a problem, they would tell us, wouldn't they? What if they didn't? He goes on to write, the death bridge was structurally deficient, we now learn, and had a rating of just 50%, the threshold for replacement. But no one appears to have erred on the side of public safety. The errors were all the other way. Would you drive your kids or let your spouse drive over a bridge that had a sign saying, caution, 50% bridge ahead? Jim Ridgway, can you put what happened in Minneapolis as they're still trying to dredge the bodies out into context of this larger story, the larger story of highway and infrastructure privatization?
Well, yeah, it's absolutely horrible. I mean, what's going on here is that this horrible disaster is going to be used as yet one more reason to privatize all this stuff. They'll say, well, you know, we didn't have the money. These Wall Street guys will give us some money. We'll fix this decaying infrastructure. But look, what's going on in Minneapolis is exactly the same thing that happened with Katrina. What happened in Katrina is that after the storm, Bush goes down there and does his meet and greet. And then, under a plan devised by Rove, they start blaming it on the states. So what happens here in Minneapolis? Yesterday, you know, we find out that this bridge was basically marked as deficient years ago. beginning 17 years ago. This is a bridge that's under the control, a highway system that's under control of the federal government, the Department of Transportation. This is a navigable river, interstate river, which is dominated by the Army Corps of Engineers. It is policed and regulated by the U.S. Coast Guard. And what happens? The president's press secretary gets up and he says, well, we told the state what to do and it's their problem. That's exactly what they did in New Orleans. That's exactly the problem here. These federal officials get away with murder. And it remains to be seen whether the members of Congress, and I'm talking about the Democratic members of Congress, have the guts, you know, to call the Secretary of Transportation and the other appropriate officials before committees in Congress and in a public session, ask them what in the world they were doing.
How much difference, Daniel Shulman, how much effect do you think this bridge collapse in Minneapolis is going to have on this trend right now? Talk about the major forces that could be held to account around the country.
It's very hard to say what type of impact this is going to have on this trend, but it's definitely picking up pace. And what I think this horrible accident did is it really highlights the fact that the nation's transportation infrastructure is crumbling, and something needs to be done. And as Jim says, hopefully this forces members of Congress to take a better look at this, because right now, you mentioned the Federal Highway Trust Fund earlier, it's going to run out of money in 2009, and not very much is being done about that. And if it does run out of money, then you're going to see this privatization trend pick up, because we're going to no longer be able to afford to keep up these interstate highways, and they will have to go into the hands of multinationals and investment banks.
Finally, Jim, before we go on to your story on Oklahoma City, what does the infrastructure of this country have to do with war? Have to do with the war in Iraq?
Well, It has everything to do with the war in Iraq. I mean, first of all, I mean, we're spending all the money in Iraq we ought to be spending on the infrastructure. This infrastructure has been going down the slope since 1970s. There's nothing new about any of this. We've been told since the 1970s. It's been on and on and on, and no one's done anything about it or done very little about it. The second thing is that Eisenhower knew that the infrastructure of the United States is absolutely crucial if you're going to defend yourself in a war, and we're supposedly in this war on terrorism. You know, I mean, a terrorist could attack any number of these, you know, susceptible targets, which are scattered around the infrastructure on railways, bridges, tunnels, etc. So it's in our own, you know, very best interest to make sure that this infrastructure of ours, which is a public endeavor after all, it's not an endeavor of Wall Street. It's something that the citizenry owns, that this is, you know, kept up to snuff.
Well, I want to thank Daniel Shulman for joining us, editor for Mother Jones, D.C. Bureau, co-wrote the article with Jim Ridgway of The Highwaymen, Why You Could Soon Be Paying Wall Street Investors, Australian Bankers, and Spanish Builders for the Privilege of Driving on American Roads. As we move on to our next segment, to most people, in the 1995 Oklahoma City bombing is a closed case. Timothy McVeigh, his accomplice Terry Nichols, were the two prime suspects accused. McVeigh was executed in 2001, Nichols serving a life sentence. But a Salt Lake City lawyer searching for the truth behind his brother's death has uncovered a wealth of new information that could implicate the FBI. The documents he dug up through countless Freedom of Information requests suggest the FBI knew about the plot to bomb the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building in advance, but did little to prevent it. Jesse Trentadue's brother, Kenny Trentadue, was found dead in his prison cell in Oklahoma City in August 1995. The FBI calls it a suicide, but Jesse maintains Kenny was beaten to death during an interrogation. Jesse has spent the last 12 years battling the Department of Justice and FBI to find out why his brother was killed. He believes the FBI mistook his brother for the missing second suspect in the Oklahoma City bombings, the so-called John Doe number two. His research also suggests the bombing was not the work of one or two men, but involved a wider network connected to the far-right white supremacist movement. Earlier this year, Jesse Trentadue's theory of a wider plot was echoed by Danny Colson, the former deputy assistant director of the FBI who was in charge of collecting evidence from the Murrah building in 95. Colson told the BBC in March of this year that he's calling for a federal grand jury investigation into the bombings because he questions whether everyone involved was caught. He also says FBI headquarters prematurely shut down their investigation into the alleged links between a white supremacist community called Elohim City and the bombings. This controversy is the subject of the latest investigation by our current guest, Jim Ridgway. It's the top story in the July-August issue of Mother Jones. It's called In Search of John Doe Number 2, the story the feds never told about the Oklahoma City bombing. James Ridgway is still with us in Washington, D.C., and Jesse Trentadue joins us on the phone from Salt Lake City. Jim, lay out the broader story here.
Well, from the point of the bombing, there was a very general suspicion and developing information that suggested that probably in addition to McVeigh and Nichols, other people were involved in this. I mean, and one of the immediate reasons was that nobody could figure out how these two guys put together this huge bomb overnight. And there were various reports, you know, of other people in the vicinity of where they were supposedly making the bomb, and so on and so forth. So there was an effort by some citizens in Oklahoma City to put together their own, you know, investigation. And they then set out to pursue and figure out, you know, who might have been involved in a wider conspiracy. And what they came to, and what came out of it, was the fact that there were federal informants, at least one and possibly three, who actually knew and were reporting on the possibility of an attack before the bombing took place. One of these informants, Carol Howe, is well known. She was at this community called Elohim City. This is a far-right, you know, religious community in Oklahoma, in the Ozarks. And she was there when they talked about bombing a federal building. She was there and actually participated in what appears to have been a kind of a reconnaissance of the building, you know, drove in a car up to Oklahoma City and stayed overnight with some of the people who are suspected of being involved. And she reported all this to her handler at the ATF, the federal ATF. And the handler testified about all this in a closed hearing in court. So it's not like, you know, this is like some informant shooting her mouth off. This is the actual employee of the ATF under oath describing the activities of an informant before the bombing took place. Then there was an informant in Cincinnati who was reporting to the FBI about another group of people who were converging on Elohim City who were thought to have been involved or possibly involved in this. And there was a third informant, and that informant was the head of Elohim City, a Pastor Millar. Pastor Millar was basically playing footsie with the FBI, trading information with them, because he was afraid his community was going to become another Waco. And his lawyer, he's now dead, but his lawyer told me recently that Millar, in effect, was trading information with the FBI about a lot of this stuff. Then there's a fourth informant, and this informant is not well known. This informant apparently reported through a nonprofit group, which in turn passed the information on to the federal government. So there were four informants involved in one way or another in this situation. And they were all reporting before, not afterwards, before this bombing took place.
Let's bring Jesse Trentadue into the conversation, the Salt Lake City attorney whose brother, Kenny Trentadue, was killed in prison in August 1995. You spent time with Nichols in January. Can you talk about what you learned? And also, there you are in Salt Lake City, what Utah has to do with this?
Well, Ms. Goodman, I got in to see Terry Nichols in January and spent a day and a half with him. He told me that after his state conviction and he received the life sentence instead of the death penalty, and he couldn't be retried, that he had written Attorney General, then Attorney General Ashcroft, and offered to tell him the whole story about everyone involved and how, as far as Nichols knew, it came down. Not only did Ashcroft not go and see him or send anyone to talk to him, but apparently issued an order barring Nichols from all media contact. What Nichols has is just his part of the story. I mean, he was involved in part of this, not the whole operation. And he talks about receiving the high-energy explosives used as a detonator from an FBI informant. And basically, as Mr. Ridgway said, this was a much bigger operation with many more people involved. And what it has to do with Oklahoma, with Salt Lake City, is I had the good fortune to have leaked to me two teletypes from the FBI headquarters sent by Director Louis Free in 1996. And they talk about this operation, and they even report that one of the informants, the informant had reported to Elohim City that 2 days or 3 days before the bombing, McVeigh had actually called asking for more help to carry out the attack. So I filed a FOIA request mirrored on these two documents. I mean, you couldn't ignore it. I mean, if you didn't search like you should under the law, you'd have to come up with at least these two documents. I did that because I knew that the FBI, given the choice, will always lie. And so they came into court and told the judge that there were no such documents. I filed the documents in court. I knew they'd come back and say they were fake. I had an affidavit from a retired FBI agent who said, no, they were real. This federal judge then ordered the FBI to do a search and to come back with all documents linking the Southern Poverty Law Center and the FBI to a failed sting operation at Elohim City connected to McVeigh and the bombing. They came back with about 150 pages. I'm sure there are many, many more, but 150 pages of documents. They were heavily redacted. They go to the judge and they say, Your Honor, don't make us turn these over because we had at least four informants who had been promised anonymity, and under the law you can't release that information. And what the judge did is said to them, black out the names and turn over the documents. And these documents, just as Mr. Ridgway said, reveal a widespread informant operation, at least in the fall of 94, leading up to and through the bombing, where the FBI and the ATF knew well in advance of April 19, 1995, that there was a bombing in place and or planning, who was involved, and did nothing to stop it. And so where we are now is I have a motion before the same judge now to take the depositions of Terry Nichols and David Paul Hammer. Now, Hammer is an inmate on death row, federal death row in Indiana, who spent 2 years with McVeigh. During those 2 years, McVeigh told him literally everything about the plot, those involved, and how it was carried out. The government's fighting me very hard to keep that from happening.
Jesse Trenta, explain what happened to Kenny, your brother, killed in prison a few months after the April 19th, 1995 bombing of the Oklahoma City building.
Well, I think, you know, the claim that this was a suicide is would make a cat laugh, and a cat doesn't have a sense of humor. He'd been beaten head to toe, front to back, throat slashed. The government tried twice to have him cremated. I had to fight like hell to get his body released. When he came home, he was heavily made up, so you couldn't see the wounds, and we stripped off the makeup and found how badly he was beaten. From that point on, it has been a nightmare fighting the government. I mean, they've tried twice to indict me. They destroyed evidence. They've threatened witnesses. The FBI has just literally run amok in this case. But what it all, how it came into play and come into play with, into place with my Oklahoma City connection, it didn't happen, Ms. Goodman, all at once. It happened gradually. And it happened, the beginning was probably January of 1996 when I received an anonymous call. And I used to get a lot of calls about my brother, and I would take all of them, and a lot of them were crank calls, but you never know, so you have to take everyone seriously. But this caller said that my brother had been killed it was a mistake, and it was an interrogation that went badly, that he fit a profile of a group who were robbing banks to fund the tax on the federal government. And I blew that off as a nut call. And then in June or July of 96, I read an article in the Los Angeles Times about a man named Richard Lee Guthrie. And Guthrie was a member of a group called the Midwest Bank Robbery Gang, who were the Aryan Republican Army, who were robbing banks to fund the tax on the federal government, a white supremacist, neo-Nazi militia type group. I thought that was... That piqued my curiosity, but they didn't have a picture of Guthrie or a description of him. And then shortly before he was executed, I received a message from Tim McVeigh, who told me that when he saw my brother's photograph and heard what happened to him, that he knew Kenny had been killed by the FBI because they thought he was Richard Lee Guthrie, who was John Doe 2. And then after that, I was contacted by J.D. Cash, who probably knows or knew more about the bombing than anybody but the people who carried it out, who connected the dots for me about the connection between my brother and Guthrie in terms of description. Largest manhunt in American history at that time, my brother was picked up and killed, was for John Doe 2. Guthrie and my brother were a perfect match. They not only looked alike, they both had a dragon tattoo on the left forearm.
Where is Guthrie today?
They found Guthrie hanging in his cell in federal custody the day before he was supposed to give an interview on the Oklahoma City bombing. And I witnessed a federal inmate named Alden Gillis Baker. And a month before our trial was to start, they found Baker hanging in his cell in federal custody.
Jim Ridgway, Mother Jones has put all of these documents on the website. Explain what they are, the significance of them, and the what do you think the chances are of reopening this case?
Well, this is actually incredible. I've never been involved with a publication which did this. I mean, thanks to the staff on Mother Jones, I mean, Celia Perry and Elizabeth Gettleman particularly. I mean, they put, I mean, I think it's literally hundreds of documents. So for your listeners, you know, you don't have to depend upon what Jesse says or what I say or agree with the article. You can go look at the pictures of Kenny. There's pictures of Kenny in the coffin. There's pictures of Kenny when he was taken down, taken out of the prison. You can look at all this stuff, and you can also look at all these different documents that the FBI claimed didn't exist. You don't have to depend upon us. And you know, the FBI says first that these documents didn't exist, then they finally produce them. Well, they're all there on Mother Jones' website, every single one of them. The only thing that's not there, as far as I know, is this big, huge report that was done by the Office of Inspector General, the Justice Department, which has been kept secret for reasons I don't get. But, I mean, I'd love to see some politician who had the guts of Mike Gravel, for example, during the Pentagon Papers, take this report, this big, thick, secret report, and dump it into the public domain in the Congress.
We're going to leave it there. I want to thank you very much for being with us. James Ridgway, Washington Bureau Chief of Mother Jones. We'll link to Mother Jones' website. Our site is democracynow.org. And Jesse Trentadue, Salt Lake City attorney, whose brother Kenny Trentadue was killed in prison a few months after the Oklahoma City bombing in August of 1995. Thank you both for being with us. This is Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
Sur. Las tierras del terror, detrás de las cortinas internacionales donde ocultan las mentiras.
Políticos de mierda que gobiernan el país. Ahora la sangre corre por los campos de maíz. Noticieros manipulados, ¿qué tal si supieran? Tal vez no votarían por estas gonorreas.
Pero no se olvide, la lucha está en pie.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we end our today's show with Colombia, 29 members of Congress have written a letter to the Attorney General of Colombia asking him to drop criminal charges against one of the country's leading human rights defenders, Iván Cepeda. Iván Cepeda has been charged with slander and libel for publicly calling for the mayor of San Onofre to resign for alleged ties to paramilitary groups. The congressional letter said in part, quote, "We're concerned the charges against Dr. Cepeda are politically motivated and form part of a broader pattern of instigating specious legal proceedings against Colombian human rights defenders in order to discredit them." Cepeda is the director of the National Movement for Victims of State Crimes, an umbrella group for more than 200 Colombian human rights groups. In 96, government forces assassinated his father, Manuel Cepeda, leading leftist senator in Colombia. Ever since, Iván Cepeda has worked to expose death squads in Colombia. In June, Human Rights First honored Cepeda by awarding him the Roger Baldwin Medal of Liberty. While he was in New York to receive the award, Iván Cepeda joined us in our Firehouse studio, along with Andrew Hudson, an attorney at Human Rights First. I began the interview by asking him to tell us the story and to explain the criminal charges.
Since 1994, we have taken a very strong campaign to ensure justice in the case of my father. 6,000 people have been assassinated in what we call a political genocide. Como resultado de esa lucha hemos logrado llevar a la cárcel a varios miembros del Ejército Nacional.
Many members of the armed forces to jail, and we have been able to clear up the relation between paramilitary groups and members of the state.
Después de estos hechos de justicia,
after
hemos
these
sido perseguidos
events,
de distintas
we have been
formas,
persecuted in many forms, threatened.
Hombres armados han estado
armed men
desarrollando actividades
have been developing activities
esquema de seguridad
against.
Y en el año 2000 tuvimos que salir al exilio.
And in 2000 we have to be we had to exile.
Hemos regresado en el año 2004 y
we returned in 2004
vivimos
and since then,
en un apartamento con ventanas y puertas blindadas.
Apartments
nos desplazamos
with blind
en la ciudad
windows,
en un vehículo blindado
and we
también,
have to be in
strong
security
measures por una organización
and we are accompanied by an international organization,
las Brigadas Internacionales de Paz.
Peace Brigades International.
En este último periodo ahora estamos enfrentando
spirit, we are confronting
no ofrece garantías para el debido
a judicial proceeding that does not offer any guarantees of due process because of accusations of slander and libel, because of having put into evidence some of the links between the state and paramilitary groups. This situation is a frequent occurring in relation to the members of the community in the human rights movement, and because of this, the organization has granted me with this distinguishment of the Liberty Medal.
Now, the man you have accused, explain what happened last November. Talk about the mayor.
Bueno, nosotros hemos desarrollado una muy fuerte acción en
we have developed a very strong action
in país,
the province of the country called Sucre.
Esta provincia es una provincia que se ha caracterizado por estas relaciones
estrechas entre paramilitares y políticos. This province has been characterized by very close relationships between the political officers and paramilitary officers. More than 3,000 people have been assassinated and have been found in mass graves.
Y por esa razón, allí hemos acompañado a la comunidad para que haga un proceso de denuncia y de búsqueda de los seres queridos que están desaparecidos.
Entonces, to make a very close following of all the people who have been disappeared.
En desarrollo de esta acción hemos señalado que el alcalde de la municipalidad donde estos hechos han ocurrido de manera más grave se llama San Onofre. Lo hemos denunciado como aliado fundamental.
We have denounced him as a fundamental ally in this process.
Mediante una acción colectiva con la comunidad logramos que fuera arrestado por la Fiscalía General.
And he was arrested by Attorney General's office.
Ahora, como consecuencia de todas estas acciones, hemos sido
as a consequence of all these actions,
en el mes de noviembre, un grupo de hombres armados,
a group of armed forces in the month of November,
que me movilizó. En ese momento no estábamos en él ni mi esposa ni yo.
In that moment, my wife and I were not in the vehicle.
Estaban buscándonos.
but many people were looking for us. We know that it was an intimidation act. It was an attempt to for enforced disappearance.
La acción que hemos desarrollado en este sitio tan estratégico en este momento en Colombia.
The action that we have developed is a strategic action.
Se ha dado en llamar la parapolítica.
And this is being called in an action in the context of a situation which is being called parapolitics.
Can you talk, Iván Cepeda, about the significance of the video that has just emerged of the president of Colombia shaking hands with, and explain who it is?
El presidente Uribe, durante toda su vida política,
during all his political career,
se ha visto de una manera u otra implicado en hechos que lo relacionan con los grupos paramilitares.
That make a relationship between him and paramilitary groups.
Gobernador de una provincia, Antioquia.
He was the mayor of a province, Antioquia,
en la que se desarrolló un modelo de seguridad
where
privada,
a security model, a private security model, was developed.
Convivir, este era el nombre que recibieron estas empresas de seguridad.
There was some specific business that was called Convivir.
Fueron la mampara mediante la cual se desarrollaron los grupos paramilitares
through which paramilitary links were developed.
Luego, en la campaña política de Uribe hacia la presidencia,
in Uribe's political campaign towards the presidency,
40 personas de sus movimientos tuvieron una reunión con los paramilitares.
About 40 people of his movement party had a meeting with paramilitary groups in a secret locality called Santa Fe.
Y ahí firmaron un acuerdo
para
avanzar hacia lo que ellos llaman la refundación de la patria.
To advance towards what
muchos
they term
políticos están the refoundation of the country. Por la Corte Suprema de Justicia. Y luego ahora, cuando Uribe es presidente, ha nombrado una serie de funcionarios.
Now Uribe, as president, he has named a series of functionaries
como aliados estrechos de los paramilitares,
who have been termed close allies.
Ahora, el presidente dice que todo eso,
the president says,
son hechos que no lo tocan a él directamente, y que él es un hombre que está luchando contra los grupos terroristas.
And that he has no links to these groups.
Todas las evidencias apuntan a que su entorno, sus amigos más estrechos,
his closest friends,
los ministros,
allies,
por lo menos cuatro de los ministros de su gabinete,
at least four of the ministers
el jefe
of his government,
de la policía secreta,
the chief of the secret intelligence forces,
todas estas personas,
all these people,
han sido
estrechos
colaboradores de los
close allies of the paramilitary groups.
Ahora, este video ya es algo más que una suposición.
This video is more than just a
proposition. Es una prueba
evidence
en la cual él está reunido con paramilitares.
That he is meeting with paramilitaries.
El gobierno ha dicho que el presidente no puede saber quiénes son cada una de las personas con las que
the government
el presidente se encuentra
president
en miles de reuniones públicas.
Who is every single person that he meets with.
Jefe paramilitar era una persona bastante reconocida.
But the chief paramilitary was a person who was very known and very.
Podrá seguir mintiendo y diciendo,
and therefore, Uribe could continue lying
pública,
and continue saying
él no conoce estas personas,
that he does not know these people.
Es una situación que veremos en el futuro.
And therefore, we will continue to see what he will say in the future about this.
Andrew Hudson, you're an attorney with Human Rights First. You are helping to lead a campaign to protect Iván Cepeda, to have the charges against him dropped. Explain what you're doing.
Well, the campaign we have to get the charges dropped against Iván is just one part of our work, one part of our program. But what we're doing at the moment is we're asking that the Attorney General in Colombia drop the charges against Iván because there's absolutely no evidence to show that these charges are in fact real. What Iván was doing, as we've heard, is he was bringing to light human rights violations that local politicians were committing. Of course, that's a fundamental right, a freedom of expression that any individual has, and it's an especially important right when someone, a human rights activist, is talking about a government official. And so what we're saying is that, you know, due process dictates that these charges should never have been brought. There wasn't sufficient evidence. The prosecutor isn't evaluating whether there's sufficient evidence to justify these charges. So we're asking that the charges be dropped. And we have a network of about 10,000 people, and we've been mobilizing that network to send emails and petitions to the Attorney General. And we've also been meeting with the Colombian government, the Colombian embassy here, and with Colombian officials who've been coming to the US. I met last week with the Colombian Human Rights Minister, and we raised these concerns directly with the Colombian government.
And you've given Ivan Cepeda an award.
Absolutely. It's not often that you can talk about good news in Colombia, especially in relation to human rights, so it's wonderful for us to have Ivan here. This year we've given him the Roger Baldwin Award, which is a prestigious human rights award named after Roger Baldwin, who was the founder of the ACLU. Every 2 years, Human Rights First gives this award to a human rights activist from around the world who's made an outstanding contribution to the promotion of human rights.
You're also working on the issue of Plan Colombia from the U.S. end. What are you calling for? And explain what Plan Colombia is.
Sure. Well, Plan Colombia is the overall foreign aid package that the U.S. gives to Colombia. And it's an enormous aid package. It's second only behind the aid that the U.S. gives to the Middle East. And what we had meetings last week with a number of members of Congress in Washington, and what we're calling for is for the military aid to Colombia to be reduced and the aid in favor of social and economic measures be increased. And specifically, we're calling for more aid to go to the Attorney General's office to protect victims in the conflict in Colombia. We've specifically asked for more money for the Human Rights Defenders Protection Program, which protects human rights activists like Ivan who are at risk. And we've also asked for new conditions in the aid to Colombia, which would ensure that government forces aren't attacking human rights activists, and that if they are, that would give the US government an ability to say, well, we're not going to give you all of this aid while you continue to persecute human rights activists. Mm.
Can you talk about Plan Colombia and what it means for your country, Ivan Cepeda?
Bueno, el Plan Colombia,
Plan Colombia
seis o siete años de estarse desarrollando
has been implemented for 6 or 7 years already.
Y se ha suscitado una polémica muy seria
and a controversial item has been raised
resultados
in relation to the results it has produced.
Para nosotros es evidente que
en Colombia, drug trafficking
continues
to occur and it is a
tan
reality,
o más which is so important, a ser aplicado el Plan Colombia.
And has even become more important
en
as Plan Colombia was applied.
Una población desplazada
we have an internally displaced population for the, by, because of the application of the plan.
Con el Ecuador,
in the frontier with Ecuador, we have 500,000 people who have been internally displaced. In great part, these
Estas
are peasants,
han visto
and these
sus
people
cultivos,
have seen their crops,
no solamente los cultivos de coca, sino
not only their
sus
coca plantations or their coca crops,
de alimentación
but their subsistence crops, the crops that provide subsistence to them, being fumigated with chemical agents
erradicar las plantas de
that
coca.
Are
y por otra
to
parte,
eradicate the crops,
estamos viendo que
coca crops,
este modelo,
and we are seeing that this model, what has done is to incentivate the war that is taking place in Colombia for the past 4 decades.
Plan, tenemos una situación
we have a situation which is growing.
Por el contrario, en el norte donde los grupos paramilitares actúan,
in the north, where paramilitary groups operate and have a strong
no
presence,
operado el Plan Colombia.
Plan Colombia has not
taken hold. Particular. Hay ciertas regiones donde se aplica en el norte del país, pero
there
en donde
are some
los paramilitares tienen sus grandes
north,
feudos, no se aplica el Plan Colombia.
But where there is a feudal system, Plan Colombia has not been applied.
Este plan no está contribuyendo ni
what
para
we believe
acabar
is that this plan is not contributing to eradicating
la paz en Colombia,
crops, coca crops, nor
los
to
nexos con grupos muy poderosos del narco
nor to break the links with drug trafficking.
Nos preocupa además que este modelo intente ser exportado ahora a países como México.
Preocupied that this model might be exported to other countries such as Mexico, where there's even conversations in relation to implementing a plan Mexico or in other Central American countries,
en un factor de desestabilización
where it has become a destabilizing factor.
Colombian human rights defender Ivan Cepeda has returned to Colombia. He has received many death threats over the past. Andrew Hudson is with Human Rights First. And that does it for our broadcast. Our website is democracynow.org. You can get the video, audio, or transcript podcast of today's broadcast. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.